Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
This campus is aware that the state of Mississippi and the national press view this as the most critical time in its 114-year history. Meredith, in the words of Attorney General Robert Kennedy, will be escorted by more than one, but less than five, federal marshals who will be armed with a federal court order that this all-white university admit its first Negro student.
Governor Barnett, we're going to leave these summons here with you. And I want to explain to you that the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit entered a temporary restraining order at 8:30 this morning, enjoining you from interfering in any way with the registration of James Meredith at the University of Mississippi.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 220. And yes, it's a continuation of the mini-wander that we're on covering James Meredith and the Oxford riots. I know. You're suffering from a little bit of battle fatigue, aren't you? No pun intended. This has been a long couple of episodes, and I get it. And I hope you'll just be patient for a little bit longer. And we'll finish this up, and then we'll begin to tie it into some more interesting themes that interconnect the radical right-wing elements that lead back to great suspicions about the Kennedy assassination. Understanding the context under which all of this occurred is critical. So, without further ado, let's listen to the rest of episode 220 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. When, by one account, a piece of lead pipe crashed down on a marshal's helmet liner, the marshals responded with tear gas. By that time, the marshals had begun to reap the consequences of Robert Kennedy's unplanned decision to move Meredith to the campus on Sunday. Katzenbach later observed that although enough officers were present at the scene to provoke the crowds, there were too few to overcome the violence that resulted. Their effectiveness was further diminished by a hasty deployment that disrupted their organization and caused them to leave bullhorns and other equipment behind. Those disadvantaged, notwithstanding, the marshals stood their ground under considerable punishment and obeyed their orders to keep their sidearms holstered unless Meredith himself was in danger, except in three cases. In those instances, marshals used their sidearms against a fire truck, a fire hose, and a speeding driverless car. The state police were of little assistance as the crisis developed. Although expected to play a leading role in maintaining law and order despite a lack of the necessary police powers, it abandoned roadblocks around the campus as a result of Colonel Thomas B. Birdsong's orders as early as 6:30. And they withdrew entirely from the campus on State Senator George M. Yarborough's orders little more than an hour later. When Robert Kennedy called Barnett to complain and the governor countermanded his subordinate's orders, some of the patrolmen resumed their former positions at the Lyceum, where one of them was seriously injured when a tear gas canister fired by a marshal accidentally hit him. With that, the patrolmen again began to withdraw, claiming that their gas masks were ineffective. 43 patrol cars loaded with highway patrolmen and other local peace officers pulled off the campus. And they did so in one big long convoy, leaving only the marshals and a handful of campus police to face the mob. Shortly afterward, Yarbrough with Barnett's other representatives returned to Jackson. Under pressure from President Kennedy, Barnett then sent Lieutenant Governor Paul B. Johnson to Oxford to move the patrolmen back and to order them to assist in restoring order. Patrolmen again manned roadblocks where Johnson later claimed that they had turned back hundreds of cars bound for the campus. Whether that was true or not, their on-again, off-again behavior did little to quell the violence. Looking back, Department of Justice officials would later admit that they had miscalculated in assuming that Colonel Birdsong would do as his counterpart at Montgomery had done the year before, and order his men to prevent violence. Even so, highway patrolmen did not join the mob, one of the few accomplishments Robert Kennedy and Blake Marshall later concluded on, an accomplishment that apparently had come from the negotiations with Barnett. In the end, Katzenbach delayed requesting federal troops for as long as possible, believing, even as conditions deteriorated, that the situation could be restored without military intervention. Bitterly disappointed, he finally asked for troops at about 8:30 that evening, Oxford time. Shortly thereafter, disheartened by the violence against the marshals and concerned that the mob might find Meredith and lynch him, President Kennedy authorized the use of troops, instructing General Billingsley to move a force of from 800 to 1,000 Federalized Guardsmen to Oxford to reinforce the marshals. Of the three major National Guard units already alerted for movement to Oxford, only the 108th Armored Cavalry received orders to depart immediately. The first of its elements arrived at the campus about midnight, Oxford time. The other two guard units left for Oxford shortly afterward. In the interim, the situation at the Lyceum worsened, leading officials to decide that more troops might be needed. At 11:33 that night, Billingsley thus received orders to initiate movement of his regular troops to support the federal marshals. Caution, nonetheless, seemed the order of the day. Although Billingsley was to begin moving all forces under his command, including the Federalized National Guard, to Oxford or other locations so that they would be in position for employment if needed, he also received word almost immediately that the president wanted him to go to Oxford himself. He was to evaluate the situation and to inform the president of what was happening before committing federal troops to action. In the end, though, events overtook those instructions. Before Billingsley could leave for Oxford, he received formal orders confirming telephonic instructions already issued, and I quote, to take all necessary action with all forces at his disposal to aid the marshals. He was to report the progress of the action as frequently as possible. As the troops began to converge on Oxford, the situation there continued to decline. By early evening, virtually all the streetlights around the campus had been either broken or shot out, and rioters had been using shotguns, rifles, and pistols under cover of darkness to fire at the marshals and others. Carl Fleming of Newsweek's Atlanta Bureau had three quick shots fired at him, but all of them missed. A number of other people were hit by birdshot. Marshal Graham E. Same of Indianapolis almost died after being hit by a bullet in the neck. Paul I. Guihard of Agence France-Presse was murdered by a gunshot in the back at close range. Walter Ray Gunter, a 23-year-old jukebox repairman from Abbeville, Mississippi, died on the way to the hospital about 11:30 after being hit in the forehead by a stray .38 caliber bullet. Gunter had fallen while watching the riot from a point near the university's new science building. With gunfire crackling in the darkness, marshals crouched behind the army trucks in front of the Lyceum. At no time did they return the rioters' fire, except with tear gas. By midnight, when most of the students had returned to their rooms, the character of the mob changed as outsiders became more and more numerous. Throughout the hours of darkness that remained, disturbing reports reached Washington that others were on their way to the town. Uncertain when the troops could be expected to arrive on the campus, and faced with a vicious mob and unable to depend upon the state police, Katzenbach found himself in an increasingly difficult position. At that juncture, however, help arose from a source close at hand. Colonel Birdsong suggested using Troop E, 108th Armored Cavalry, a local guard unit that was awaiting orders at the Oxford Armory. Welcoming the idea, Katzenbach secured President Kennedy's consent. And at 10 minutes to midnight, he telephoned the troop commander, Captain Murray C. Faulkner, a nephew of the novelist William Faulkner. And he would tell him that Kennedy had ordered Troop E to the campus. With a strength of 3 officers and 71 enlisted men, the unit had been ordered to its station at the Oxford Armory that day, and by mid-afternoon, all but 3 enlisted men had reported. Believing that the president had federalized the guard, only to remove it from the governor's control, Faulkner had not expected to become directly involved in the Meredith affair. Nevertheless, he had made preparations. At the armory, where the troops flew both the American and Mississippi flags, Faulkner posted a guard to keep reporters away and ordered his men to load equipment in duffel bags and to be ready to move on short notice. When he heard radio reports of cars headed toward Oxford, Faulkner conferred with his executive officer and decided to issue M1 rifles as far as they would go. But until he received Katzenbach's call, he doubted that his unit would be ordered to the campus. Katzenbach instructed Faulkner to surround the Lyceum and then to report to him. Faulkner explained that he had only 2 officers besides himself and only 71 enlisted men, and that the troop had only a few hours of riot training. He could have added that he had no tear gas. Nevertheless, he told Katzenbach that he would leave the armory in 10 minutes and be at the Lyceum in less than 15. While his men lined up, the troop's little convoy of 4 jeeps and 3 trucks, Faulkner telephoned his squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel James R. Williams, because he was uncertain about the civilian channel through which he had received his orders. Williams instructed him to comply, first authorizing ammunition for the troop, and then instructing Faulkner to leave his ammunition at the armory. Right at 10 o'clock, Katzenbach called again to see if the troop was ready to pull out. When Faulkner replied that it was, Katzenbach asked him if he was positive and then instructed him to make sure the enlisted men were loaded aboard their trucks and would follow him to the Lyceum. Katzenbach did not suggest any route to take from the armory or tell him what to expect from the mob. He also failed to mention that tear gas was heavy about at the Lyceum. Leaving the armory, Faulkner turned his convoy onto University Avenue and then, for no reason that he would later recollect, ordered his men to put on their gas masks. Fortunately, the tarpaulin covers on the vehicles had not been rolled back, providing some protection. Faulkner took the shortest route, straight west through Oxford on University Avenue. Reflecting upon Katzenbach's questions about his men and their readiness, he realized that federal officials questioned their loyalty. Although he believed that his men were segregationists, the thought that they might not obey orders or follow him seemed impossible. As the convoy passed the high school, people on both sides of the street yelled and threw rocks. From the time Faulkner and his men crossed the bridge over Hillgard Cut and the Illinois Central Railroad tracks at the entrance to the university campus, where the crowds thronged along the street, the guardsmen were constantly yelled at and cursed at. Then they approached the scene of the riot. As Faulkner would recall it later, I could see the mob in the Grove and the Lyceum building. It appeared the Grove was full of people, and the street on which we were to drive was a sea of people. The only lights were at the Lyceum, and the glow from a burning automobile was there. As we passed the geology building and the Confederate statue, a 2x6 piece of lumber was thrown at my Jeep. Fortunately, it missed its target. From here to the Lyceum building was absolute hell. People would not move out of the street. They threw bricks, concrete, everything and anything they could find, including words. I leaned over to my driver and screamed for him to put the Jeep in second gear and not to slow down or stop for anything. Bricks battered the sides of the trucks and fell into the back. If there had been any doubt as to whether the men would follow me, there was none now, Faulkner recalled. I was indubitably sure I had their support. A person loose in that mob, wearing a uniform, would have been dead. Now we were all concerned with a matter of self-preservation. A barricade of 3 concrete benches had been placed across the street, but the Jeep dodged them. A brick came through the windshield, raining shattered glass. Something white came toward Faulkner's face, and he instinctively threw up his left arm. The missile broke 3 bones and cut his wrist. 3 of the following vehicles smashed into the concrete benches that had been placed across the street, providing more ammunition for the mob. When the convoy finally reached the Lyceum, Faulkner remembered the marshals laid down a volley of tear gas for us to drive through. Upon later examination, Faulkner found his vehicles more beat up than he had ever seen before. One of the Jeeps had 6 bullet holes in the right side of the windshield. All had broken windshields or windows. In his own Jeep, he found 7 bricks and a Molotov cocktail that had failed to ignite. There was also a bullet hole in the radiator. At the Lyceum, Faulkner ordered his men to fall in with the marshals while he reported to Katzenbach. It was 10:10, only 20 minutes since Katzenbach had first called him. After deploying his troops as Katzenbach wished, Faulkner looked after his casualties. Most of the wall space was taken up by hurt men, he later recalled, one of whom had glass in his eye from the shattered eyepiece of a gas mask, while another had an elbow swollen to half again its normal size. At Katzenbach's request, Faulkner took a bullhorn and, with about 6 of his men, went before the mob in an effort to reason with the rioters. When the bullhorn stopped working, the mob rushed forward, but he and his troops returned safely to the Lyceum under cover of tear gas. He tried again with another group of volunteers, but stones and curses again flew, and he had to retreat. By then, he had only 1 uninjured officer. He sent the man to the airport with his 3 trucks to pick up General Billingsley and his staff, who were expected soon. From conversations with some of the marshals, he learned that their supply of tear gas was running low. At that point, Faulkner thought he had heard the sound of trucks coming toward the Lyceum. In fact, it was a bulldozer driven by a rioter. Marshals dragged the man off his makeshift tank. The next threat came from a fire truck that attempted to hose the defenders. Agile marshals captured the driver and stopped the truck on its 3rd pass. It was not until after these occurrences, apparently, that Faulkner sought medical attention for his injured arm. Meanwhile, an ambulance had managed to reach the back of the Lyceum, where highway patrolmen were also taking away the injured. At about 8:45, 5 minutes after he received orders to move guardsmen to Oxford, General Billingsley had ordered Troop E's parent unit, the 108th Cavalry, then on a short 1-hour alert, to move immediately to Oxford from its headquarters in Tupelo, about 50 miles away. It was the closest to Oxford of the 3 major National Guard units originally instructed to be in Oxford on Monday morning. The unit commander, Colonel James G. Martin, reached the Oxford Armory at about 10:30 that night. There he found the howitzer battery and Troop G of the 108th 2nd Reconnaissance Squadron, which had just arrived just ahead of him. For the first time, He learned that Troop E had been committed not long before and that he should look to Katzenbach for instructions. By telephone, Katzenbach ordered Martin, in the name of the president, to commit whatever force he had at once to relieve the pressure that was building on the Lyceum. But the effort to prepare and instruct the men delayed their departure from the armory until midnight, about the time that Billingsley arrived at the airport from Tennessee. Meanwhile, General Abrams had reported to Washington that three troops of the 108th were in Oxford, but that only one had been committed. Word quickly returned that the president wanted the other two troops moved onto the campus as soon as possible. Major Warwick B. Bean, the 108th's regimental operations officer, led the battery in Troop G, about 95 strong, to the campus. The men carried rifles with sheathed bayonets. They had ammunition in their pockets, but were under orders to load only at an officer's command. Bean led this force up University Avenue to the same kind of a reception at the Circle that Troop E had received. The mob smashed the windshield of Bean's Jeep and put Troop G's Captain Hassel Franklin out of action with a bleeding mouth and a smashed finger. Bean reached the Lyceum at about 25 minutes after midnight and stationed his troopers on the north side and at the rear of the building. Unimpressed by the arrival of reinforcements, the mob set one truck's tarpaulin on fire and put a bullet into the radiator of another. The first hour of October 1st was marked by heavy firing from the rioters. During a volley of shots into the front of the Lyceum, Faulkner observed several of his men accidentally knocking down marshals as they hit the dirt. Another group of three or four guardsmen from his troop decided to take a smoke break, but could not approach the front door because of marshals clamoring to get in. As time went by, firing came from all directions. Several of Faulkner's men were hit by spent bullets falling to the ground after striking the columns of the Lyceum. Colonel Martin had already reconnoitered the campus while Bean and his force were en route to the Lyceum. He noted that some 25 patrol cars were parked at the alumni building, but that highway patrolmen themselves were doing little to restore order and greeted him in a most antagonistic manner. In the absence of tear gas, Martin concluded that it would be impossible to disperse this mob with anything less than firepower. Guardsmen continued to arrive. The headquarters of Troop F of the 108th 2nd Reconnaissance Squadron reached the Army at about 10 minutes to 1 in the morning. 40 minutes later, the 3rd Reconnaissance Squadron followed, minus its Troop H. By this time, 6 cases of tear gas had been obtained from the supply dump at the airport. The 1st Reconnaissance Squadron arrived in Oxford at about 2 o'clock in the morning, about the time General Billingsley and the 1st Active Army troops reached the Lyceum. Regimental officers had devised a plan and issued orders for deployment on the campus. Since no maps were available, bits and pieces of information from guardsmen who had familiarity with the campus went into the regimental operational plan. They used a rough sketch on a blackboard. This plan called for the 1st and 3rd squadrons to clear the campus of the mob, while part of the 2nd squadron remained in reserve. The 1st squadron was to move directly west on University Avenue, while the 3rd squadron moved to the north side of the campus and entered the circle from that direction. By then, however, regular troops were on the move. President Kennedy's address early in the evening had sent a surge of relief through Task Force Alpha. At 9 o'clock that evening on September 30th, the unit had received orders to release its entire load of tear gas for airlift to the marshals in Oxford. An hour later, however, when orders arrived to prepare for movement to Mississippi, it had to reclaim the gas. At that point, Billingsley requested permission for his troops to take rifles into the objective area instead of the nightsticks specified along with pistols in his orders. General Abrams authorized the change once Billingsley assured him it would cause no delay. to President Kennedy, preoccupied with a serious riot in progress, the movement of the troops to Oxford was agonizingly slow, making him, and I quote, furious, especially when he was unable to reach General Billingsley himself. Robert Kennedy, who later complained that we didn't have an exercise with the army in which they didn't screw it up, was not only angry, but also remorseful. He thought he had let his brother down because he had chosen to use marshals, and, when needed, the troops had not arrived within 2 hours of notification as the military had supposedly promised. But the delay stemmed from the younger Kennedy's decision not to have the troops in Mississippi or even to place them on alert because, and I quote, that would have destroyed the whole idea of the marshals. And of course, the army was not even informed that Meredith was being placed on the campus on Sunday instead of Monday as planned. Thus, Robert Kennedy had good reason to blame himself for what happened and for observing to Anthony Lewis in 1964 that the procedure followed was right, the execution was wrong, and the person responsible for the execution was me. Military records and recollections are not in exact agreement as to the time it took for the troops to reach the riot from the Memphis staging area, but they are sufficient to conclude that it took about 4 hours, and not the 5 hours that Robert Kennedy claimed. And nowhere do they confirm anything, even near the two-hour promise that Robert Kennedy claimed the military had made. General Abrams later agreed with General Wheeler, who thought that changing from nightsticks to rifles could have taken more than a few minutes, and that the troops came within about 20 minutes of keeping to their postulated schedule. Abrams admitted, though, that so much was happening that he never checked the time that the order actually came down to commit the troops in support of the marshals. He had no reference point for estimating the time taken, he told Wheeler, and neither did anyone else. These, however, were not General Abrams' final thoughts on the subject. The lack of communications that prevented President Kennedy from reaching General Billingsley at Oxford created an odd situation. Billingsley's party left the Memphis staging area at about 11:15 that night and arrived at the University Oxford Airport with the first of the troops. The general immediately telephoned Katzenbach, who told him the situation at the Lyceum was critical. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel L. Gordon Hill, Billingsley's principal information officer, placed a collect call to the Army War Room in the Pentagon from a public telephone booth at the airport, the only one available because security considerations had prevented the Signal Corps from installing equipment ahead of time. For 5.5 hours until the airport personnel expelled him at about 7 o'clock on the morning of October 1st, Hill kept this line open. With the help of Major William J. Koch, he received intelligence from the campus, monitored various federal and state police radio messages, and relayed the information to Washington. Billingsley's instructions were for Captain Fred J. Villela, Company A of the 503rd Military Police Battalion, that is, Task Force Alpha, to be airlifted by helicopter from the Memphis staging area to Oxford. The remainder of the battalion would travel by road. Company A's orders, issued about 10 o'clock on September 30th that night, were to assemble on the airstrip at the Memphis Naval Air Station, where the soldiers received M1 rifles, M1 carbines, and a .45 caliber ammunition and some 10 cases of M25A1 tear gas grenades. The unit also took 16 shotguns with 500 shells. The unit's personnel boarded the helicopters in haste and at random, apparently without regard for establishing loading patterns. The first helicopter, whose passengers included the battalion and company commanders and several enlisted men, took off at 11:49 p.m. A reconnaissance helicopter that had gone ahead radioed that the area about the Lyceum was insecure and that the company should land at the University Oxford Airport. The first helicopter reached its destination at about 30 minutes past midnight on October 1st. The other helicopters then began landing at two-minute intervals. By about 1:11 that morning, all had arrived and had been unloaded. In the darkness, amid the roar of arriving and departing helicopters and other aircraft, assembly of Company A's personnel, approximately 119 men, proved difficult. As Billingsley shouted desperately for speed, a young Texan, Lieutenant Donnie Bowman, received command of the riot platoon, to which a shotgun squad of 12 men was attached. Bayonets were fixed on all rifles, and 7 men were designated to remain at the airport with the baggage and the gas grenades. The trucks that Faulkner had sent to the airport were not used for the trip to the campus. Instead, the men were loaded into 4 Navy buses. The journey was an unnerving experience, with natural anxieties sharpened in the lead bus by the blaring of a radio whose announcer described the mob violence and the plight of the marshals at the Lyceum, now not far away. In this atmosphere, the company commander ordered rifles loaded and locked. Suddenly, there was a shot, immediately suggesting an ambush in the dark. But no one had been injured, and investigation showed that a soldier loading his rifle in the darkness had accidentally fired a bullet through the roof of the bus. The tactical plan, composed en route to Oxford, sketched a line of approach that would have brought the buses to the Lyceum from the rear rather than have them drive through the worst of the mob. For reasons that remain unclear, the convoy failed to use the plan and went instead to the Sorority Row entrance to the campus, a route that went right into the front of the Lyceum. Billingsley's command report stated that a carload of marshals who knew the route led the buses. The authors of the 503rd Command report had a different explanation. They asserted that the buses had, in fact, been directed to the entrance by the Mississippi Highway Patrol, whose motives appeared questionable. As the buses unloaded at the bus entrance at about 1:30 in the morning or so, the men were ordered into formation. State troopers and others lounging nearby harassed them, shining lights in the faces of the company's black soldiers and making offensive remarks. As jibes continued about the marshal's treatment of students and the Army's use of bayonets, Lieutenant Bowman arranged 2 squads of the riot platoon in wedge formation and positioned his shotgun squad to the rear to cover his left and right flanks. The other platoon, which included the company's headquarters personnel, immediately followed in column formation. Captain Villela, the company commander, came next. Also in the formation were Billingsley in a Border Patrol sedan, other officers, and a lieutenant from Captain Faulkner's troop, who served as a guide. The order was to proceed quickly. With bayonets fixed, the troops marched in cadence. The air was chilly and at first quiet. The route, about 7/10 of a mile in length, lay in darkness through a gully and then up a steep curving hill past sorority houses to the chancellor's residence. On the right, at the crest of the hill, stood a small group of spectators, their calm creating a false sense of security as the troops marched past, although distant shouts and other noises could be heard. Soon the troops were passing the chancellor's residence and bearing right onto Grove Loop. With the wooded grove on their left, the troops bore down upon the YMCA building near the circle. There, elements of the mob surging about the grove in a circle waylaid them with a shower of Molotov cocktails, bricks, and rocks. Many of the troops were hit. The commander himself, unmasked, urged his men to take the abuse and not to break formation. The point man of the wedge felt the slap of his sergeant's hand on his buttocks, urging him not to falter. Indeed, if the men had not kept on their way in riot formation, they might well have been either overwhelmed or forced to use firearms. As it was, the battalion and Task Force Alpha commander, Lieutenant Colonel John J. Flanagan, later told a reporter that if any of his men had been burned by Molotov cocktails, he might have ordered the use of shotguns. The men were wearing so many straps that they couldn't have gotten out of their clothes if they had been set afire. Company A kept its forward motion and emerged from the ambush without serious injury. The Lyceum lay just ahead. The weary marshals in their gas masks greeted the troops with unrestrained applause and muffled cheers. The company quickly deployed along the roadway in front of the Lyceum with the immobilized fire truck and bulldozer to its right. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, Oxford time, and 4 o'clock in the morning in Washington, just 4 hours after Billingsley received the final order to relieve the marshals. He and the battalion commander, Flanagan, conferred with Katzenbach inside the Lyceum. Outside, the mob attacked with Molotov cocktails and rocks, and the regulars responded with tear gas. Their grenade throwers protected by the rifles and bayonets of the company's skirmish line. The soldiers fired no shots. When Vilela reported inside the Lyceum at about 3 o'clock in the morning, he received instructions to send a squad of 24 men to assist the marshals guarding Meredith's residence at Baxter Hall. Lieutenant Bowman, with 23 enlisted men and a marshal to guide them, secured the building without meeting any significant resistance. On the way to the campus, the 1st Reconnaissance Squadron, 108th Armored Cavalry, ran the same gauntlet that Troop E and other units of the 2nd Squadron had run. One missile struck the squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel Guy J. Gravely, Jr., in his midsection. His driver crashed his Jeep through a crude timber and concrete roadblock, knocking debris in every direction. Missiles thrown by the mob knocked out vehicular radio power packs, and one Molotov cocktail set fire to a tarpaulin on a truck. At one point, the convoy had to leave the road to bypass the flaming wreckage of these three automobiles. When it reached the Lyceum, 15 marshals covered its unloading. Meanwhile, only minutes before the 1st Squadron arrived in its trucks, the 3rd Squadron moved in from the northern edge of the campus, approaching the circle in columns of sixes with unsheathed bayonets. Taking its share of whatever was thrown but making effective use of tear gas, it broke through in front of the line of military policemen and marshals. One officer went down. Another's helmet was creased, apparently by a piece of pipe. The time was about 3 o'clock in the morning. As daybreak neared, the troops, now in adequate strength, took the offensive, forming a skirmish line that included about 200 marshals and 400 soldiers. They began to push the mob away from the Lyceum and off the campus. Included were Company A, 503rd Military Police Battalion of Task Force Alpha. The 1st Squadron cleared the northern side of the campus and the 3rd, the eastern. Company A moved only as far as the bridge over Hillgard Cut, apprehending several rioters and returning them to the Lyceum. From there on, the main burden of the work fell to the guardsmen. One of Troop E's men picked up a brick thrown at the troops, first ammunition he had all night. He was about to throw it back when he was ordered not to do so. The process was difficult to control and not always orderly. At several points during the retreat, rioters stopped in an effort to talk. Several times during the action, enlisted men of Troop E broke formation, raced toward the mob, and had to be ordered back. When the troops moving eastward were ordered to halt at the corner of University Avenue and South Fifth Street, the portion of the mob they were pursuing moved to the corner of South Lamar Boulevard and University Avenue, where it continued to make trouble until dispersed later in the morning. Left behind on the campus was what Captain Vilela described as a mass of rocks, bricks, broken Coke bottles, tear gas containers, and broken windshield glass. Wrecked and overturned cars littered the grounds, along with a host of others exhibiting broken window and glass and great dents in their sides and in their hoods. At approximately 6 o'clock that morning, Company A moved in column to Baxter Hall, its way strewn with glass bottles, rocks, and numerous overturned concrete benches. The unit established a bivouac in an adjacent playing field. As reports came in, they indicated the trouble had not been limited to Oxford. In the land convoy of Task Force Alpha were Companies B and C of the 503rd under the command of Major Raymond E. Levan, the battalion's executive officer. With 161 Jeeps and trucks, LeVan's column cleared the Memphis Naval Air Station at about 11:40 Sunday evening. Along the way, it received its only information about Oxford from transistor radios belonging to some of the men. As the situation seemed to grow worse, the column speeded up dangerously until it sometimes traveled at 45 miles an hour. According to the official command report, it was neither assisted nor delayed by the Mississippi State Troopers. But, as LeVan put it, to say that the state police gave no trouble would be eyewash and untrue. About 26 miles from Oxford, the convoy passed two state police monitoring vehicles. And about 8 or 10 miles from Oxford, it was stopped by a roadblock of 20 or 25 scout cars. Major LeVan advised the officer in charge that his was a federal troop convoy and demanded that the road be opened and that the convoy be allowed to pass unmolested. LeVan also requested the officer to clear the convoy through any other roadblocks that might lie ahead. Apparently, the officer complied because there was no interference with the convoy at two additional roadblocks it passed, although officers and men heard such remarks as "goddamn Yankees" and "nigger lovers," shouts that would occur as they sped by. As the convoy approached Oxford on Highway 6, LeVan observed things did not appear to be just right at the Illinois Central Overpass just ahead. Apparently, to see better, LeVan stood up in his Jeep as it passed under the bridge. As he did so, about five persons, as he states, five persons or so, it appeared to him, dropped a railroad tie, which missed him but smashed the back of his Jeep. Another open Jeep in the convoy overturned when a truck or some scrapped portion of one was dropped from the bridge on top of it. The convoy continued, however, and a local policeman at a filling station directed LeVan and his command to the Oxford Armory, which they reached about 4 o'clock in the morning. From the armory, LeVan set out for the campus by a roundabout way. When black soldiers were spotted among the rear elements of the column, however, objects of all types were thrown and injured some of the men. LeVan then diverted the convoy to the town square, procured maps from the National Guard, and sent 8 combat jeeps to reconnoiter 2 lateral roads to the campus. Rioters smashed all 8 windshields before this party returned, causing LeVan to bring 10 combat vehicles forward and to arm their riders with shotguns in plain view of everybody in the square. He instructed his men that the shotguns were to be used only if their lives were endangered and ordered the men to don masks to protect themselves from flying objects. Finally, the convoy set off for the campus by way of University Avenue, mother routes being too narrow and convenient for ambushers.
Hello?
All right.
Governor?
President? Yes, sir.
Oh, will you talk to Mr. Watkins? The Attorney General did.
No, I haven't talked with him now in a couple of hours.
Oh, well, now...
I met him, though, about 2 hours ago, Mr. President. He said he was going to talk with the Attorney General and go see him tomorrow morning.
Oh, well, in the meanwhile, then, the Attorney General talked to Mr. Watkins to see whether there was some... Wait just a second. The Attorney General's right here. He'll tell you what he talked to Watkins, and Watkins is going to talk to you. Wait a minute.
All right.
You'll come right on the other phone, will you?
Yes, all right.
Hello?
Yes, sir. General, how are you?
Fine, Governor. How are you?
Fine.
I talked to Mr. Watkins, you know, earlier this morning.
Oh, yes.
And he really did not have much of a suggestion. He had mentioned yesterday the possibility of our coming in tomorrow, Monday, with marshals, and that as under our understanding for Thursday, that the marshals would show up and that you and the others would step aside, Mr. Meredith would come into the university. Well, he felt that when he mentioned, he talked to me today, he said that he thought that that would create some problems which they could not overcome. And he suggested at that time some alternatives which were not very satisfactory.
Well,
and then he mentioned the fact that he might come up early tomorrow morning.
Well,
I called him back after I heard the president's conversation with you and said that I thought I'd be glad to see him, but I thought that unless we had some real basis for some understanding and working out this very, very difficult problem, that really he was wasting his time. and that one of the basic requirements, in my judgment, was the maintenance of law and order, and that would require some very strong and vocal action by you yourself.
I'm certainly going to try to maintain law and order, Mr. General. Just the very best way that I can.
But then
I talked with the student body the other day and told them, really, to have control of the physical and mental faculties, but it didn't do much good, seemed like.
Well,
they cheered and carried on, but then they just started raving and carrying on, you know.
Yeah. I think, Governor, that if we, as a very minimum and as a start, an order by you and the state, that people could not congregate in Oxford now in groups of three or five, or larger than groups of three or five. The second, to get the school authorities to issue instructions to the students that if they congregate in groups that they are liable for expulsion. If that was done this afternoon, I think that would be a big step forward, and that anybody carrying an arm or arms or a club or anything like that would be liable to punishment. Those kind of steps by you would indicate an interest in maintaining law and order.
Well, General, I'll tell the Chancellor to announce to all the students to keep law and order and keep cool heads. But the trouble is, not only the students, but it's so many thousands of outsiders will be there.
Yeah, but I think if you said, Governor, not just to keep cool heads, but that they couldn't congregate.
How many do you figure on sending down?
Well, I think that the president had some questions for you that he thought that maybe if we could get some answers to them, that would be what depends.
Mr. President? General, why don't you, I believe if you and Tom Watkins could get together, it'd help a lot. He's a very reasonable man, and he knows the situation down here as well as anybody living. If you all could get together tomorrow morning, I really think it would pay. I think it would help.
Well, he doesn't have any suggestions. He just told me. Mr. Governor.
Yes, well,
so I don't know what
I thought he did have.
Well, he didn't. I mean, he said something about sending the Meredith, sneaking him into Jackson and getting him registered while all of you were up at Oxford, but that doesn't make much sense, does it?
Thank you for listening to episode 220 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Please join us in episode 221, where we continue the story of James Meredith and the Oxford Riot. Thank you.